This one out, so here's your new one. It doesn't always work for me. So I'm using a backup.
Okay,
so today I want to do two different classes. Half an hour of Sefer Chinuch and half an hour of Amalek, because it's right before Purim. So I feel like this is our chance. Well, how can we not like notice that it's there? So we'll do half an hour and half an hour. So, and these are we're going to go through pretty quickly, because we're working on the Korbanot. Did you put a new battery in there by any chance?
I sure did.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's kind of crying on the wall there.
It'll be okay.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. The precept of the Kohen Gadol's daily meal offering.
We were just reading all these.
Yeah, we're actually right by the parsha right now.
We just read all these. Reading through it, I was going, oh.
I recognize this. Yeah, we saw the word Malika. That was in this week's last week's parsha.
Yeah, it was very good.
So it was interesting. I thought about that reading it also. Okay, so the precept of the Kohen Gadol's daily meal offering, that's called a mincha offering. Mitzvat korban mincha shel Kohen Gadol b'chol yom. So the Kohen Gadol has to offer his own mincha offering twice a day, every day. So it's an interesting thought, because he is the messenger between, so it says in the second paragraph here, he's the messenger between the Israelites and their Father in heaven. So he entreats Hashem in prayer on their behalf. And through his prayers and the service of his offering, they find atonement. So it's interesting. I mean, the concept of a, not exactly a conduit, but he is there to help facilitate that. So, but in order for him to properly facilitate prayer, he has to be in a prayerful state. So that's what this mitzvah is about, is he has to keep himself in a place of connection. So a twice-a-day offering for himself. And it's interesting also to think about, I don't know if it's the latest research I actually have, I didn't get to read yet, but I have saved on my computer a New York Times article on meditation and how it changes the brain.
It does.
I think that was about a month ago.
So,
but the concept for, anyway, what I've learned in general is that it could change the brain meditation, but visualization and things like that can last up to 20 hours. So let's say you're a diabetic that's trying to visualize your sugar being in good balance. You have to meditate about that twice a day, because it only lasts for 20, it could last up to 20 hours. So it's a twice a day concept. You need to really put in time twice a day to manage the mind balance over body concepts if you're putting in that energy. So here he also has, or maybe we learn from this, a twice a day concept that
interesting.
That's not enough to do it once a day. He has to bring it twice a day, every day, to keep himself in the place. So that's what it says in paragraph 3. Beyond any doubt, there can be no comparison between the arousal in a man when he brings an offering that is specifically for him and the arousal when he brings an offering in which he merely has a share. This is something known and experienced by everyone. That by what is especially for him alone, a person is stirred the more. There's no need to go on about it. So we do know it makes a difference. You know, if you want to give somebody a present, so you give it alone. It's one like it's sort of like the yeshiva shalach manas, which is very nice. You know, instead of giving so much candy to everybody and spending so much money, so you spend the one price to yeshiva for each name on the list. You're spending the same, but the yeshiva gets the money, and now your name goes on a list, and each person gets one shalach manas with a bunch of names on it. So it's nice, and it's the right thing to do. Instead of giving out 100, and yet it's not the same.
Quite the same as handing out that.
It's
right,
not
one
the same, right?
That one.
Right. It's just not. So I make a list of all the people I want to pay attention to, and then that's the yeshiva ones, and then the ones who need it, or the ones who need that special connection in relationship. So somebody who's older or lonely or whatever it is, like somebody who needs some extra attention. But it does make a difference to give that gift yourself. So that's what this is saying is, yeah, it's one thing for him to be offering offerings all day long, but he needs to be offering his own twice a day. Okay, and it's interesting that just the last paragraph of this mitzvah, this mitzvah counts as one mitzvah, not two.
Oh, even though he does it twice.
Right. Oh, wait a second. Yeah. Even though he does it twice, and everybody agrees on this, even the Ramban of blessed memory, who counted the two daily offerings as two. Right, because there's different mitzvah counts in the 613.
Right.
So they differ in some places like this, for instance. Does the Olah offering count as two or one? So even those who feel that counts as two believe this counts as one.
Right.
Okay, next, 137. That the meal offering, the mincha offering of a Kohen, should not be eaten. So we just spoke about Kohen Gadol. Now this is Kohen. So a Kohen, so in general, if an individual brings a mincha offering, so part of it is eaten. But if the Kohen brings a mincha offering, it's not eaten.
Just a meal offering or any offering?
Well, and this, so...
And this one's talking
if
about
If I would know
offering.
All of them memorized, I'd be able to answer that, but I don't know.
Just this one's a meal offering, so for sure this.
This one particularly, okay. For sure not, because it seems that it's interesting, because in some offerings where we feel we should be eating it, where the mitzvah is to eat it, so that brings to a different arousal of sense of self and how you're supposed to interplay with this. In this particular case, one is not supposed to eat it, and you can't even eat of each other's, because then you're like, it's like it gets eaten. So it's okay in some cases to eat it, and the Kohanim eat from other people's offerings,
right,
but they
yeah.
can't eat from their own, because I think that would bring it down in their eyes. I think that's what this is saying, is that it will seem to him as though he baked bread for his own need and ate it. And even if his colleagues eat of his mincha and he eats of theirs, it will amount to the same thing. Therefore, he commanded that it should be burned altogether, not eaten by any man. So Kohen's mincha offerings are not eaten at all, whereas other people's are. and then it talks about, how the handful is made. So that's kind of just an interesting thought. And it seems that there may even be, there's a question in the text, if there was a mistake in the text on how it's gathered, but it's just interesting that here it talks about what does a handful look like? Is a handful with your hands like this?
It was like the three fingers.
Or like that? Or like that?
That's what they had in the parsha this week. They talked about the three fingers.
Right. So that concept of handful and how you take a handful is discussed and what that means. So, and there's additional information on that available in the Nachot if anybody wants to look that up. And the ban on eating the mincha of a kohen applies to both men and women when the temple is existent. If somebody violated it, then they get whiplashes. Okay, the next, the precept of the sacrifice of the chatat. The chatat, I spelled it differently here, sorry, because I don't have a little dot to put under my H on my computer. I probably do.
Yeah,
probably find it. Search for that insert button. But anyway, there's different ways to spell the chat in English, so... I did it with the CH, chatat, and put the yud in between, because it's chatat. But it's not an ayin, it's an aleph. It's just an aleph that you hear a little bit more. You don't usually hear an aleph, but chatat. You hear it kind of. Okay. So, this is interesting, just because it says.
We already discussed it.
Right. Been there, discussed that. Even though he has two pages on it.
He does,
right. Right. So that the Kohanim should sacrifice a chatat in the way mentioned in the writ, whatever chatat it may be, so whether it's domestic beast or fowl, as is stated, this is the law of the sin offering. So they also have to offer, they also have to offer, but we said earlier about the details of the offerings, we don't know about the details. And with that, he acquits himself of his obligation. There could be some people who know Kabbalah and know some of these things, but he's saying, I don't know. So he's just going to talk about how it works, though, the actual, how you bring it, and how it works halachically. So Rambam of Blessed Memory does not count the law of Chatat, of the Hasham, of the Ola, of the Shalom, in the reckoning of the 613, on account of this basic principle that I've stated, right? For the main commandment applies to the obligation of bringing the sacrifices, so he's not going to count each one.
So he just says one, and he's... Then it's so funny, he says, well, we're following the Rambam, we said we were, so we are, so we're not going to, you know...
Right.
We're just going.
Right. So it's interesting just to see the way... Yeah. The way that he discusses it and the way the Rambam counts it.
So what we discussed burning before, and this is bringing?
The other one was to...
Well, we started with the mincha.
We started with the mincha offering of the kohen.
The other one about the...
When we talked about the...
It was bringing it. And this one is burning it?
This is the precept of the sacrifice. Mitzvah maaseh chadat. Yeah, about it. Just about it. We said, so this is a different korban, because there's all kinds of different korbanot. Right. Right, so what could be brought is each one. There's so it's interesting how the mitzvahs are divided up, and it's interesting also, as I looked, and I don't think it's there because I think I looked hard enough. I'm not 100. I'll, you know, you never know. But I looked for the mitzvah of remembering to wipe out Amalek. You'd think that'd be one of the 613 because it says it so clearly. Remember to wipe out the memory.
But they don't count it anywhere.
I didn't see it there. So, and I think I looked carefully enough, but so I don't want to swear to it, but so it's just interesting how the reckoning is. You know, what gets counted as a mitzvah and what doesn't, even though that's explicit in the text, remember, and we have it in the back of our siddur, that's a daily remembrance, if you choose to remember that every day, and yet that's not counted. So here now, all the offerings. So it is a question of how you count the 613. 613 we all agree on. How you count them is a question. So, but he goes by the Rambam. That's his main halachic decisor, which is what he says in the last paragraph of page 91. Nevertheless, we shall not swerve from the way of reckoning of the Rambam of blessed memory and the precepts which we have firmly adopted. And if something is difficult, we will attribute the difficulty to ourselves, not to him. For he, in truth, is our very reason for this occupation. On his account we arrived at it. May the righteous man rest in his repose. That's interesting, right? Yenuach hatzadik al mishkavo. And then he just continues on with the different... so there's all kinds of laws in here, which we're not going to look into, but except for I want to give you one vocabulary word, which is emorim. So you'll see that a few times in the English on this page, on page 93... Right, and it's because right. it must be spelled with an ayin. Mm-hmm. Looking in the Hebrew quickly. No, it's not. Emorim is spelled with an aleph.
Aleph?
Yeah, and yet, for some reason, it's got the little apostrophe and the thingy, emorim, yeah. But the emorim are the guts, the insides of the the entrails.
The entrails.
Yeah, the stuff that's on the entrails. The fat, which is, let's see, it says, now these are the emorim of an ox or goat, the fat which is on the entrails, including the fat on the maw, the stomach, the two kidneys, and the fat on them, with the fat that is on the loins, the appendage of the liver called the plugar in the foreign tongue Spanish.
Okay.
And the bit of the liver that was taken with the appendage. It's interesting that sometimes in these commentaries, you see, you can learn something about an older language. Rashi is used. For a source of Old French, in order to examine Old French, because he uses this a lot. Like here he's using Spanish. It's any foreign tongue where it says in the foreign tongue, right here.
Which was Spanish. It's what they were talking.
Well,
about.
No. It's a foreign tongue. In this case, it's Spanish.
Oh, okay.
In the Hebrew, it says loazi. Loazi stands for lashon am zar, the language of a foreign nation. Lashon am zar, loaz. So loazi makes it into an adjective. So loazi is just something that belongs to another nation. So here's a word in loazi. In this case, that's why he's identifying it in these parentheses here, in these brackets. The loazi is Spanish. Rashi's loazi is French. Right. So, but Rashi uses enough Old French that he's actually used it as a historic source for Old French. That's what I'm saying. He uses enough throughout his commentary that... For
people
French reasons, he's used to be able to figure out pronunciations and words that were used. Anyway, so that's what the emorim are, all these parts of the stuff that's parts of the entrails that are also offered up. So there is a part of the chatat that's eaten and part that's burned, and you have to, you know, somebody who offers it up has to know how to
divide
cut what from what so that you know what to burn and what to eat. and this is a law that applies to male kohanim because they're the ones who are doing the slicing of the insides of the animal. And if he transgressed and did not offer up the chatat lawfully, he would disobey this positive precept. So it's a positive precept. Okay, 139. Not to eat of any chatat whose blood is sprinkled within. Excuse me. Okay, so this is interesting because there's some that you can and some that you can't. So the kohanim should not eat of the flesh. It's the kohen that eats of the chatat. Should not eat of the flesh of the chatat offerings that are sacrificed within the holy chamber, i.e., of those sin offerings of whose blood they would sprinkle on the inner altar, which was in the Heichal. For it is stated, and any sin offering from whose blood is brought into the tent of the meeting to make atonement in the holy place shall not be eaten, it shall be burned with fire. So, I don't see I did not understand how they're divided up, because some are burned within and some are burned without.
And so they sprinkle the blood on the four corners.
Right, and some inside. So the ones where they're doing that inside, you can't eat from those. And the ones that they sprinkle on the outside, you can't eat from those. Right, it doesn't say in here. Do you see where it says in here? The same law holds for sin offerings that were to be burned, whose blood is sprinkled on the inner altar, that if its blood is brought within the curtain, whereas the Holy of Holies, it becomes disqualified, unacceptable.
So if it comes in through the main entrance, then you can't, but if it comes in through a small opening in a gate, or...
Right. So, you can't eat that if it's there. So there is the category of chatat, where the blood is brought to the inner sanctum that you can't eat. And if somebody does, even an olive's worth, up to an olive's worth, that's where they get the punishment. They get whiplashes. I forgot to mention, and somebody has it on their paper, you have it on yours, that we're dedicating this class to Irving Schaefer, who is Alona Weinman's father, and his name is Yitzhak Hakoin Ben Rivka. He should have her full name, but he's in the hospital right now. Jake called to ask us to put him on in our thoughts for this class.
I can also add on Rhoda's behalf, her father-in-law, Binyamin Ben Chavamalka, who is Mishon Shehaven Aliyah.
Yeah, except for you don't say Chavamalka anymore.
Oh, right, okay, I'm sorry.
What's his name? Do you know?
Okay. I don't know his father's name, sure.
Right, so there's an Hashem Shadav and Leah, right. But once you die, you daven for them in the father's name.
He's the same.
Right. The precept of the sacrifice of the Hashem. 140, right? That's what we're going to get up to today, and then we're doing Amalek. Great. Okay. That we were commanded that the Kohanim should perform the task of the Hashem offering in the way you mentioned in the scriptures. And this is the law of the guilt offering, as it is written. Now I have told you firmly that it's not for us to write any root reason for these tasks, since they are akin to details of an offering. There's no point in seeking about after their reasons, as these matters are locked and sealed. So that's interesting. As to the laws of the Hashem, we mentioned some of them above in Sidra Vayikra, in the 10th positive precept. It remains for us to convey that an Hashem is never brought from any creatures but male sheep alone. There is an Hashem that comes from the grown ones of the species, and some are brought from the young. As regards the task of ritual slaying, sprinkling the blood, applying the salt, the emorim, and the eating of the flesh, the law for all Hashem offerings is the same, except for the Hashem of a Metzorah, as there is a slight difference in the way the blood is collected. These and other details of the precept are explained in Zvachim. It's in effect when the temple is existent for the male Kohanim, and if Kohanim doesn't do it the right way, he's disobeying this positive precept. That's what I prepared for next time. I guess I'll have to just save that then. Flag.
Yeah. I guess it's just not for us to know this.
Right, so that's why I wanted to kind of go through these quickly, because...
He doesn't say too much, he just says...
Well, he's telling you how to do it, right. That he doesn't have the details. So, I'm sure if we would learn it more...
If you were a doll, you would know the details.
Well, you'd know the details, and I'm sure there's a lot of secrets in here, you know, that...
That you could find.
That we could probably find some of. I think once one would really delve into the Korbanot deeply, one would start to understand it more, but it would require laying down quite a foundation of knowledge. So, that's not where I'm currently holding, and I want to be able to move through the book so that we get the whole view. Mm-hmm. So I think we're not going to do that this time through, but you shouldn't, I mean, it's important to recognize, and we're going to continue
on. There's
a lot of ink on this.
Right.
That's the point. That's what I want to say here, is that we're going to continue going, and there's going to be other parts.
Right.
It might get a little bit, I don't want to say boring, but like redundant maybe, or it seems like it's just a lot on the sacrifices. It is.
There's a lot on the sacrifices.
A lot of the 613 mitzvot are on offerings.
How many are there?
Less than half that we can do. Though.
No, I know, but how many are?
How many sacrifices altogether? There's a lot.
I mean, there's a lot.
And how many mitzvahs apply to that? That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious, because it seems like we've been doing stuff about sacrifices for quite a while.
Yeah.
And we're not done.
Right.
And it just seems like there's really, really a lot.
Right.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
There are certain things that, like, the Kohen knew that he couldn't share in terms of information on what he was doing, or, I don't know. It's kind of like, you know, the Chevra Kedisha is very quiet, so was the Kohen Gadol also very quiet? Or?
Mm-hmm. So that's the question.
That's the question. Was he?
Oh, was
are there
like
certain
that?
Things that we're not allowed to know because he had to keep it kind of quiet?
I'm not aware that he was required to keep secrets. Although there were some things like there, you know, exact recipes of things were not shared. I mean, they were kept even in certain families. Was that to keep it secret, or was that just because they're the ones who held that knowledge? I don't know enough to be able to tell you for sure that he had to keep it secret. The Chevra Kedisha, as far as I know, also doesn't have to keep things
right.
secret, but there are certain things that are kept quieter.
Yeah.
So that is a concept within our tradition,
mm-hmm.
is that there are aspects of things that should be kept quieter. I think about the Chevra Kedisha, it's because it has to do with death.
Right.
And it seems that there is a concept that what you're learning about, you encounter. So,
say that again?
What you're learning about, you
encounter. Okay,
I find it somewhere in your life.
I understand.
Right, so that there is a tradition not to learn the laws of death and mourning unless you're
really
in that parsha. Right, so even rabbis, I mean, they have to learn enough to be able to minister to people when they need it, but they're not supposed to delve into it, and people often skip those sections because there is a concept of the learning that one engages in moves spiritual forces and brings things closer to them in their lives. So people don't want to engage in that type of learning. But that concept also should help us understand, let's say we're having a hard time with something, so we should learn about simcha, or we should learn about, you know, things like that, which will bring it into our lives more. Let's say learn about the halachas of parnasa, if we need more parnasa. You know, so learn the halachas of how to give tzedakah so that we have the opportunity to be able to give tzedakah, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So we do have concepts of what we learn about comes into our lives. It's interesting to think about, you know, this family, Neshama should have an aliyah, the Fogel family that was murdered in Israel.
Mm-hmm. We have a story
Shabbos,
about that.
So sad.
Five
of a family of eight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear about them?
Mother,
so
I was talking about it. It happened.
Mother,
a
father, an 11-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 3-month-old.
Mm.
And the 12-year-old discovered them when she
and
came.
And there were two other kids.
And then two other kids sleeping.
In
they
a
didn't
different
kill.
Room.
Just, I guess, they skipped that room, a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old. So one of the things I was reading said, you know, this week's Parsha was, two people said, so this week's Parsha had Amalek in it, or we're learning about Amalek now, and we see that Amalek is still alive. So that was one person's thought. And another person said, we learned this week about Karbanos in the Parsha, but who would have thought there would be Karbanos like this? So I was just thinking about that statement, because on the one hand, we do think about them as being Karbanos, but how? And in the light of this, like, how do we think of that? Is it Karbanos? Like,
yeah,
it's not close.
It doesn't seem like.
So on the one hand, it's not close makers that we bring, if I'm translating Korban as a close maker, right? So it's not that we brought it to bring us close, although it does serve the function, because each one of us is, our hearts are going out to that family and to the community and 20,000 people at the funeral, and, like, you know, around the world we feel more connected to each other. So in that sense, it makes us closer to each other. And also helps us cry out. I mean, that's the mitzvah d'oraisa of tefillah. The actual biblical commandment of davening is when you're in pain, to cry out and say, Ribbono shel Olam, please switch it around. You know, we're in a time period of v'nahapachu, of flipping things. That's what Purim is about. One of the themes of Purim is to flip things over. So apparently, and I hope that, you know, there are foiled, but apparently the Arabs are planning a day of rage on either on Purim or on Tanis Esther. I'm not sure which one, but I think it's on Purim. Anyway, they're planning a day of rage either this Thursday or Sunday.
Of course.
Right. Because they do understand what Purim is about and that they are the target of it. So may they continue to be
foiled. Well, it's interesting, I read in the paper there when we were before we left, that there was speculation that it was just sort of some rogue people because they use knives. right.
to as opposed to guns. And they said that they, well, that was, yeah. it was in the paper.
It was there, right,
I don't yeah. know. Yeah. But that was what they speculated that it wasn't a...
Oh, a settlement family. The family in a settlement.
Whole family?
Five out of eight.
Five out of eight.
No. Who? How many did the killing?
They think
they didn't
two.
Catch them yet.
They think two. They think two. The speculation was that there were two people, Palestinians. They breached the fence.
The West.
They apparently the fence. They got notice that the fence had been breached, but on the kibbutz or on the settlement, and they went to check it, and they didn't see anything. They did not report it to the military. And it was like 45 minutes or longer after the breach before the killings occurred. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of speculation about whether they followed proper protocol in terms of reporting or not reporting.
Right, so that's what I said, is that the blame game started immediately. Right. You know, like whose fault was it? You know, was it the Moshav's fault because they didn't have
they said they
a
not.
Good enough fence?
They said
but
they
but
not.
At the Moshav, they said they knew they didn't have a good enough fence, and they complained to the military. So there was a complaint lodged. So was it the military's fault that they didn't come and fix up the fence? Not that the fence was broken, but it just wasn't good enough. It wasn't secure enough. They didn't have cameras and what they wanted. So everybody's blaming each other because, yeah.
But they did say people are dead. They had followed the protocol.
Right, so it's not, that's what people, so that's what I was going to say, is that people want to blame each other. And people want to find fault. And I think there are some people who want to say, because we didn't find the man, who says they're Palestinians? Who says they were terrorists?
Well, they were.
Clearly. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you know,
clearly
like,
they were.
You know, but people want to say that, who says? It could have just been some people who came in who like to kill.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
They said no.
But that's what they're saying so far. Who says they're Palestinians? You're just jumping to that conclusion? Just because Jews are dead, that it was Palestinians who did it? You know, so yes.
The odds are more likely than not that right. was what it was.
Right.
So. I don't know for sure, but that's pretty likely.
Right.
It's pretty terrible.
Yeah. And then the media is just... it didn't make the front page of the Times today because they decided...
Yesterday on the Times.
Today, yeah, Barry, but it wasn't on the front... It wasn't even a little box mm-hmm. on the front page. But today on the front page, because the response is that they're going to allow some more building...
400 buildings.
That was on the front page.
Yeah,
oh, of course.
That more building is going to be allowed in the settlements, and then like the third and paragraph.
And then there was a bunch of, you know, a lot of the settlers.
Yeah.
On our page
many
also.
Eyes. Many eyes burn on it. 400 eyes for eight eyes.
Well, so that's the difference, is that we don't do eyes.
I know, we do buildings.
We do buildings, right. Right, mm-hmm. So they do babies and we do buildings. And we just have to, that's so important to keep in mind. You know, that they're killing because of concrete. That's what's bothering them. It's not what's bothering them, obviously, but it's
the land, too.
Yeah, but they're killing because of it. We're putting up houses, and they're killing babies. So, okay, so that brings us then to this mitzvah of wiping out the memory of Amalek. Okay, I'm just going to switch this.
So it is a mitzvah, but we don't know...